Well, a few weeks ago, I met a member of our church for breakfast one morning. We hadn't seen each other since before the pandemic set in. He started off by saying, "You remember the sermon series you did back in January, Vision 2020? Boy, did you miss it." I thought, well, perhaps. He said, "Perhaps. No, man, you weren't even in the ballpark." I said, "Well, I think there might have been a couple of things." He goes, "A couple of things? No way, you weren't even close." I finally gave up. We had a good laugh about it, but later when I was walking to the car, I thought about that old saying, "You want to make God laugh? Tell God your plans." Well, I don't know that God laughs at our plans, but we can all relate to having a lot of our plans changed this year, can't we? Who would have thought back in January that we would be familiar with acronyms and phrases like COVID, coronavirus disease, PPE, social distancing, contact tracing, super spreader? You know, if you'd have asked me a year ago, what's a super spreader? I would have thought you're talking about farm equipment. Some time ago, a person sent me this meme. As you can tell, it's a row of porta toilets on fire. And you can see the caption, "If 2020 were a scented candle." You gotta laugh, right? I'm sure a lot of us feel that way, that much of what we had planned and intended for this year has just gone up in smoke. A lot of people have experienced loss this year. Loss of jobs. Loss of savings. People have lost loved ones. People have had to let go of many things this year. But letting go is part of the spiritual life. Jesus said, unless a kernel of wheat dies and falls into the earth, in other words, unless it lets go of life, it can't come back to life and produce new seeds. The writer of Ecclesiastes said, "Cast your bread upon the water, it will come back to you." The very symbol of our faith is a cross, reminding us that through sacrifice, there can be resurrection, new life. In letting go, we can receive. So today we start a sermon series called Letting Go, and it's a stewardship series. Now, many of you who've been in church for a while know that that is a very churchy word, and it's code language for some of you that means give your money. No wonder a lot of people don't like stewardship. And in full disclosure, that is part of it. But it's just part of it. Stewardship strikes at the very heart of the spiritual life because we understand that life is about rhythms of giving up. In fact, you don't even have to be a spiritual person to understand this truth. Everybody gets it, that life is a series of having to let go of things. Everybody understands that eventually, one day, we let go of everything we have. So in this series, we're going to talk about many of the important things we let go of in life and understand that with God's help, that letting go opens us to receive. We're going to spend this series focusing on one book of the New Testament, Paul's letter to the Philippians. Paul wrote this letter most likely from prison to the small church in Philippi, a city located in the northern part of Greece, just a few miles from the Aegean Sea. Paul went there on his second missionary journey. It's located along the Via Ignatia, a main east-west highway in the Roman Empire, sort of like I-70, but imagine I-70 as if there were no I-40 or I-80 or any other east-west highway in the United States. How much traffic would we see? That was the Via Ignatia. Philippi was only 10,000 people, a small city even in that time, but it's a place that would have seen a lot of travelers, a lot of people coming through. It was a political place. It was a Roman city, which means certain people had rights. If you were born in Philippi, you were a Roman citizen. It was named for the daughter of Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great, Alexander's sister, Philippi. It was the place where Mark Antony and Octavius, the person who became Caesar Augustus, tracked down Brutus and Cassius, the assassins of Julius Caesar. Paul went there. He shared faith with people while he was in Philippi, and a woman named Lydia came to faith under Paul's ministry. She became the leader of the church that met in her house. Many years later, Paul writes them. And this letter, many scholars say, is a letter about joy. Over a dozen times, Paul uses the word joy or rejoice in these four simple chapters, just a little over 100 verses. But Paul does not write about joy in denial of the hardships of life. He reminded them, I'm writing to you from prison. And he knew of their hardships. Paul writes to remind them that the circumstances around us, even though we have to let go of a lot of things in life, doesn't mean we can't have joy. So Paul begins in the section we're looking at today, in the middle of the letter, with a warning. Now, a warning seems counter to the tone of joy, doesn't it? But Paul wants the people to understand if you want to have joy in your life, you better be aware of the things that can rob your joy. Be aware of the people and the experiences that can steal your joy. That's as important as the celebrating joy. So, he says in the opening of chapter 3, beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of those who mutilate the flesh. Who is Paul talking about? He's not talking about the vilest of sinners, murderers, rapists, gang leaders. He's talking about religious people. People who are so caught up in their right beliefs and their practices of religion, they believe that everybody had to live that way. The mutilators of the flesh. He's talking about those who said circumcision is what you have to be a part of the community of faith. Paul says, watch out for these people. He knew all the way from the prison in Caesarea what was going on in Philippi, that they were coming into the church and laying on the people these heavy burdens that was robbing their joy. And Paul says, look, I understand these people. I was one of them. I was circumcised on the eighth day of my life. I was a member of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. I was a Pharisee who followed the law to perfection, and I came to see it didn't matter worth a hill of beans. Paul said to them, those things were important to me, but now I think they are worth nothing. Because of Christ, I regard them as rubbish. That word rubbish in Greek is the word skubala. Skubala is not a polite word. It means waste, but to be more specific, human waste. Are you with me? Paul was saying to them, that all of these things that once gave him a feeling of being right with God, he considers now a bunch of burning porta toilets. Why is Paul so indignant? It's not because he disregarded the significance of his religious background. There are too many places in the New Testament where Paul speaks with gratitude for his religious heritage. He doesn't disregard that background. But he's warning people about what that can become if you're not careful. Certainty. Certainty that you have a handle on God. certainty that you're right and other people are wrong. Certainty that if you live the right way, God is always going to come through for you as if God owes you a favor. And Paul was writing to say, I've discovered in my life that certainty wasn't what I needed. This past week, Ryan Poe, our newest member of the church staff, put a book in my hand called The Sin of Certainty, Why God Desires Our Trust More Than Our Correct Beliefs. It's by Peter Enns. And he tells his own story about growing up in a religious environment that placed such a heavy emphasis on right thinking and right beliefs and knowing God. And through the experiences of his life, he came to a place where he realized that wasn't enough. There was so much more that he was needing in his spiritual life. He says these words, "A faith that rests on knowing, where you have to know what you believe in order to have faith, is disaster upon disaster waiting to happen. It values too highly our mental abilities. All it takes to ruin that kind of faith is a better argument." And there's always a better argument out there somewhere. "The problem is trusting our beliefs rather than trusting God." I understand what that kind of religious life looks like. Some years ago, I went to a mountain climbing school in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State. I wanted to learn skills for mountain climbing. I had a guide and there was one other couple, just the four of us, on this glacier for a week. At the end of the week, I wanted to do a little more, just for a couple of days, to learn rock climbing skills. So we went to a different location. It was just the guide and myself, and we got to know each other quite well. During breaks, we would talk. He knew I was a pastor. We would bring up faith topics at night, sitting around the campfire. We'd talk about religion, and I learned a little bit about him. He had grown up in church, but he got turned off with church. He was in a church that didn't welcome his questions very well. And as I investigated more about where he is in his faith life, he just said, "You know, I've done some different things. Right now, I find Buddhism is what works best for me." I was at a place in my own faith journey and pastoral leadership that I was being challenged to stretch my work as an evangelist, my faith sharing, my trying to be a helpful spiritual influence for other people. But the modeling that I had was I needed to convert people. I needed to give them the answers. And that's what I tried to do. I wish I could remember what I said. It was probably pretty dumb. But what I won't forget is the look in his eye, his expression, where I could tell the curtain just went up. And without saying a word, I felt he was telling me, "You people are all alike." I tried to stay in touch with him when I got home from the trip. Is it any wonder that he didn't? Why did I do that? Why do any Christians feel the need to do that? Why is it we believe that if we just have the right answers, that's what matters most? If we just impart our divine privileged information, we're going to give somebody all that they need. Is it because we're trying to convince ourselves? Maybe. I certainly wish I wouldn't have given them answers. I wish I would have shared my own questions, the things I struggle with, the things I wasn't sure about, my own searching. I wish I would have applauded him for the seeking that he was doing. You know what I do know? Is that Paul said having all the right answers wasn't enough. That he got to a place where he was able to consider it all rubbish, scuballa, I don't think Paul was angry when he wrote those words. I think he was kind of laughing. I think he was chuckling when he wrote them and trying to say to the Philippians, oh my goodness, there was a time in my life I thought it was important. I thought that if I just knew the right information, that it would give me what I need. But you know what it turned me into? It turned me into a self-righteous prat. It sent me out on a witch hunt to gun down other Christians. It made me so pompous. It took me away from God. My certainty became a wedge in my relationship. And until I met Jesus Christ, did I even discover what had been missing all along? It wasn't certainty. It was trust. Through Christ, I found a connection with God that gave me a trust. That's what I needed. Jack Kavanaugh, Jesuit philosopher, went to work with Mother Teresa in 1975. He was struggling spiritually, looking for answers. The first day, Mother Teresa came to him and said, "How can I pray for you?" He said, "Pray that I have clarity." She said, "No, can't do it." He said, "Why not?" She said, "Clarity is the last thing you're clinging to, and it's what you must let go of." He said, "But Mother Teresa, you seem to be so full of clarity." She just laughed. She said, I've never had clarity. All I've had is trust. I will pray that you have trust. Look at this verse from Philippians 3, 7 and 8 that's in the Message translation. "Yes, all the things I once thought were so important are gone from my life. Compared to the high privilege of knowing Christ Jesus as my master firsthand, everything I once thought I had going for me is insignificant. I've dumped it all in the trash so that I could embrace Christ and be embraced by him." Paul said that's what is enough for me. Is it enough for you? Is trust what you need today? Is trust what you need in your religious life? To know that trying to do all the right things and learn all the right information is not what is needed most. It's important. It's important to know, but not in replacement of trust. That what we need most is a trust in God who believes in us even when we doubt, who believes in us even when we're not so sure about who God is, who never gives up on us, but we just trust it anyway. Maybe trust is what you need in this political climate. There are people on both sides of the issues going on today who look at the other sides and get so mad you just want to choke people and say, "How can people think that way?" And you just want to get burning mad about it. And you start to say, "Oh, if this election doesn't go this way, things are going to be terrible." And maybe what we need the most is trust. Trust to know, this is my Father's world. And though the wrong be off so strong, God is the ruler yet. Maybe you need trust in what's happened in your life this year. You've lost so much. You believe that if you just live a good life and you work hard, God's going to look out for you. But now the results haven't turned out that way. And you're trying to make sense of it. And it's not making a whole lot of sense. Maybe what you need instead of sense and answers is just trust that God is still at work. I want to close with this picture of the Nantahala River in North Carolina. It's a famous whitewater rafting river, as you see this group in the river. I've probably rafted this river dozens of times. I love it because there are places along the Nantahala River where the water's really calm. You can beach your raft. You can just get out and swim in the river. Then there are places where the current picks up. There are rapids, and you have to paddle, and it adds some excitement to the trip. But the best is saved for last. At the very end of the route is a class 4 rapid where the water shoots between these boulders. And as you can see in this picture now, the raft has gone through the rapid and everybody is holding up their paddle. It can be a dangerous rapid. You see, before you hit the current and the rapid, there's an eddy, there's a little whirlpool. And if you don't guide yourself correctly around it, you can hit that eddy and it'll turn you sideways. You do not want to go down this rapid sideways. You can get flipped out. And if your feet get caught under the rocks, the current is too strong for you to stand up. People have drowned there. But if you do it right, if you steer yourself in and do the best you can, when you hit the rapid, then the thing that you do is now stop trying. You lift the paddle out of the water and you just let the current carry you through and you trust you're going to be okay. Now, one added feature is there's a viewing gallery right above the rapid. So not only do you have to worry about getting through there, you have to worry about looking good at the same time. Whenever you're watching people, you can tell the ones who are going through for the first time. There's a look of sheer terror on their face. And when people get to that moment where they know they're out of control, they can't control the situation, there is no certainty, they want to dig into certainty. They want to put their paddle in the water and try to control it. And that's the worst thing you can do. That's the most dangerous thing you can do. Look at this last picture. Is that not a picture of pure fear on that girl's face? But she's doing it right. She's holding up her paddle and she's letting the river carry her through. Now, if that's any kind of appropriate analogy for our faith, we might wonder, well, why do there have to be rapids in the river? Why can't God prevent that? Why can't it always just be an easy float? But I believe God is the water. God is the water that carries us. Sometimes there are places along the trip where we are confident and in control, and we can get into the river and swim and just enjoy God. And sometimes the water gets rough. Sometimes the river turns violent. And we do the very best we can, but when we get in the middle of it and fear kicks in, we just let go. And we trust that God will carry us. That's what we need the most. It's trust.